Tubes. We talked last week about the powerlessness of ourselves to decide for God. We talked about how it's a miracle if God changes a person's heart, if he wakes up a spiritually dead person to come to him. We see that King Nebuchadnezzar heard the right message last week. He drew the right conclusion. He said the right words, but it did him no spiritual good. Facts do not save a person. Christ does. If the Holy Spirit doesn't empower the gospel in a person's life, that person's decisions will never result in salvation, no matter how accurate or sincere they are at the time. It has to be God's work accompanied with people's decision. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar had said this to Daniel: "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." We long for people to say that, people who don't know God, who come to this conclusion and they say that. But the tragedy is he may well have said also, "But I will never bow my heart to him." What we see this morning shouldn't surprise us. Here's the same king in verse one of our text. And the next thing, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. After all that, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. We will learn later what that's for. The image represents the king's gods. Isn't that absurd? He makes his image to the king's gods, his powerless gods that could not tell the king his own dream. It's likely that bowing down to the idol would have been bowing down both to the king and to his gods. I think that's kind of implied in a lot of people's understanding of how this worked. Now, remember the statue that the king saw in his dream. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. But there were a bunch of after this kingdoms, you know, the bronze and the silver and the iron and the pottery. And it's very, very likely that after the king had time to think about this, in his selfish pride, he rejected the whole idea that this Jewish God was truly in charge. The statue he had made was very different than the one that he had in his dream. The statue he made was all gold. It was as if to say, "My kingdom will reign. This head of gold isn't going anywhere. It'll be my kingdom that will fill the earth." And it was very likely a statement of rebellion against the one true God. Notice, too, where it was placed. He set it up in the plain of Dura. From what I read, many think that this is where the Tower of Babel was first built. And remember what the Tower of Babel was for. We'll read that this morning because I think it's important. Genesis 11, 1 through 9. "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. And then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.' And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men had built. And the Lord said, 'Behold, they are one people, and they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. And nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they may not understand one another's speech.' So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of the earth." Now, the tower was being built as a tribute to humankind and to consolidate humankind. It was man's attempt to replace God with themselves. It was humanism in its purest form, and God confused it and scattered humans across the globe. Now, what do you think the devil's will is for this world? This is what he's always wanted. He doesn't care so much if he is not worshiped as long as God is not worshiped. Any substitute will do. So he inspires King Nebuchadnezzar through the world or the flesh or by direct influence, we don't know how, to repeat the rebellion. Step two, plan two. And the king makes a statue in his honor of his gods and probably himself. Now, this statue is 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. If you envision that, that's a weird looking statue of a person. That would be one skinny dude. The proportions of that statue would have been strange, unless it's actually like a pillar and then it has a statue on top that is in man's proportions. That could easily be. We're not given a lot of details. But now keep in mind, this statue is on a plain. It's on a plateau. It's a very, very flat piece of land. Have you ever noticed how far you can see out in the ocean or across a lake, a big lake? Well, this statue would have been like that. It would have been visible for miles. And being made out of gold, it would shine like a light when the sun hit it. That was by design. The king was aware how magnificent and impressive this statue would be. Then look who he compels to be there. Then the king sent to gather all of the people that Jared read earlier. And they came out to the dedication. And then it says they all came. And they stood before the image that the king had set up. Now, I don't want to go through each position that's mentioned here. Some are unclear, and I don't think that's the point. The point is that everyone in a position of leadership and influence, except maybe Daniel for some unknown reason that everyone guesses and nobody knows why, was required to be there. Everyone's required to be there. At least all the leadership is. And this wasn't limited to Babylon. Like, we've heard a lot about what's going on in Babylon in that province, but this is everywhere in the kingdom. These people would have had to travel great distances. It would have taken days for them to get there. And every land that Babylon had conquered had some form of leadership, and most everyone was there of that leadership. Now, in my experience in corporations, they only do that when they want to accomplish something very, very significant. There's a great deal of money and time spent on something like this. It's not something you just blow money at. We see this as a top priority for the king. I believe he wanted everyone in the whole kingdom to understand that everyone everywhere was to worship at the feet of this statue, to worship at the feet of the gods of Nebuchadnezzar, to worship essentially at the feet of Nebuchadnezzar. He wanted their top allegiance to be to him and to his gods. Every other thing could be worshiped. That's okay. But it had to be subservient to that. When these people were sent home, it would be with the mandate that everyone is to worship the ruler of the kingdom. He had to have the highest allegiance in everyone's life. That's what this meeting was all about. Other gods could be worshiped as long as the king reigned supreme. That was the message. So while the Tower of Babel had all people together in their worship of man, and God dispersed them in the original Tower of Babel, now the king is bringing all people back together under the worship of man. Naturally, that's not something that God will allow forever. And God in a dream had set up an image, remember? God in a dream had set up the image he wanted. The image God created in the king's mind reflected the truth and, in the end, displayed the glory of God. That was God's image. In our text, it says that this is an image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. And that wording is significant. It's set up by a man to glorify man. Verse 4, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of all those musical instruments, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." I'm not going to go into the depths on the instruments used. Many of those are also uncertain. But I think we can assume that the sound that would issue forth would have been impressive. I think that's the point. It was going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience when you hear this orchestra break out. The airwaves would be filled with beautiful and awe-inspiring sound. I'm sure if amplifiers had been available at the time, you would have had quite the sound. The experience itself would tend to be worshipful, would lift you up, you know, from your present experience. Now, this is a principle, and you find it lots of places. In fact, it was interesting what we heard in Sunday school, how well it fits in with what we're talking about. The world will inevitably demand that you worship what they worship, if you want to enjoy the fruits that they enjoy. And it makes sense. The devil is given lots of leeway in his limited rule on this planet, and he hates God. So everything he does is to accomplish the goal of harming God with the limited powers that he has. Our highest purpose as human beings is to glorify God. That's what we were created for. That's what we're designed for. That makes the devil's highest goal to have humans dishonor God, at least one of his highest goals. Maybe nothing dishonors God more than worship of something else. Idolatry has always been repugnant to God. It is offensive to God and destructive to us. Well, here, King Nebuchadnezzar demands it on threat of death. He demands idolatry from his people. I was reading a commentary that I thought really captured the issue. You and I aren't likely to be pulled out into the middle of a public meeting where we're forced to bow down to a statue of the mayor, you know, or something like that. But the principle still remains. The world is making us choose. Here's the quote that I really like. I've also come to see that the same battle is actually being fought out daily in my heart over much lesser issues. Am I going to declare the Lord to be my God, my primary allegiance, come what may? Or will I bow down to the multitude of glittering idols that the world presents to me? These idols are not physical statues in our setting, of course. They are the various pleasures, the desires, and the attitudes that society tells me I need to have if I'm to be fulfilled and lead a worthwhile life. They promise to bless me if I'll bow down to them, but to curse me and ruin my life if I fail to meet their demands. For some, the golden image is the respect, and this is still in the quote. For some, the golden image is the respect and admiration of others. As young people, we often feel the pressure to be one of the in crowd at school, even though the cost of admission to this club is that we mustn't show respect for our parents or talk about God or keep ourselves mentally and physically pure until marriage. Bow down to me, the image says, or I will throw you into the fiery furnace of the mockery and ridicule of your peers. This idolatry was described by C.S. Lewis as the allure of the inner ring. The allure of the inner ring. The desire to be on the right side of an invisible line that divides insiders from outsiders. Indeed, the power of this idol is such that, in the opinion of Lewis, of all the passions, the passion for the inner ring is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things. Our environment is changing to actually more overtly demand worship. I believe it won't be long before people in upper management at corporations will be required to bow at the altar of the woke agenda in order to keep their jobs. That was happening in my world. I know my boss's boss was sold into that stuff and had to have programs promoting all that stuff. This is a real world example that is similar to the worship that King Nebuchadnezzar required. But it's even more subtle than that, often much more subtle and pervasive. Like C.S. Lewis said, think about the people you want to be liked by, people you want to be accepted by. Young people especially need to watch what they do and say when there is a new person in the group. I don't know if you've ever watched, but what happens when that happens? What happens when that dynamic changes? It's often disheartening what happens when a young people has new people added in their circle. Sometimes it brings out their Christ-likeness, but often it brings out flesh. What we're watching for here is compromise. Compromise. Compromise is when you go against what you know or sense is right because you want something else so badly. Sometimes you want to avoid rejection and harm. Sometimes you want acceptance and approval. Will you show disrespect to your parents for young people to impress somebody? Will you allow people to be made fun of and hurt when you're in a group? Will you stop caring about the least popular people being left out of your group? I mean, this is, it's more evident with younger people and younger groups. It's more obvious. But the same thing can happen with us. And as we get older, it doesn't get easier. The world will push us for worship. It will demand compromise. That's the nature of our world. Christ alone is worthy of worship. But if we're not careful, we'll find ourselves worshiping at the world's altars. Verse 7, therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard music, the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, dragon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. No surprise here. We should never be surprised when the world worships at its own temples. And that's what we see here. In this case, it seems that everyone appeared to think it better to worship than to die. So, you know, as far as we're seeing here, there was camaraderie on this issue. But, you know, that's not always the case. And sometimes it throws us for a loop. Sometimes I think, especially how we have raised our kids, it sometimes doesn't really prepare them for what they might see in the world. There are people who do not follow Christ, who value principles more than their lives. And they won't violate those principles. And we should thank God that this is true. Sometimes the world shows a great deal of nobility, and it certainly makes the neighborhoods better to live in. They may value freedom. They may value honor. That too can make them uncompromising. We need to think accurately about this. While no one is good intrinsically, many people do have noble traits. Many are kinder and more principled than we are. But those traits do not consist of a worship of God if they don't come from a relationship with God. Sticking to a principle at the cost of one's life is different than choosing to worship God first and only. Note, too, that it says all the peoples fell down. And that's just one more example of how careful we have to be when we're interpreting the scripture and the word all shows up. We've always got to see it in context. It looks like this is referring to the great throng of people. And if you were a bypasser and you looked out at the throng of people, you would say all of them were bowed down. But we know it did not include the three Hebrew children. We're going to go farther in our text today, even though we didn't read it earlier. I had left it out. Verse 8, therefore, at that time, the certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. When we choose not to worship at the altar of the world, that will often not go unnoticed, even if that's the only thing that we did. It'll draw attention. I think of Tim Tebow's testimony and how he was treated. He made a quiet stand, and all he was doing was witnessing. You know, all he was doing is talking about God. He made a quiet stand, and he got got attacked from all sides. And that's not unusual. Remember that the Chaldeans were the home team in the mystical division. And Daniel had saved them from death. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were part of that salvation. They were part of those prayers. Now, we might think that the Chaldeans would be grateful. I mean, saved his life, you would think. But no. Gratitude is not usually a driving factor in politics. They were not grateful. They were probably envious. They held malice toward the Hebrews. And the Chaldeans wanted to see the Jewish team suffer. They wanted them eliminated. It removed all their competition. The problem is, in this case, they had evidence. The Jewish team was guilty of violating the king's rules. First, the Chaldeans quoted the rule to the king, and then they spilled the beans. Verse 12, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you set up. When you're trying to get someone in trouble, how do you do it? We were all kids. Does one of your kids ever tell on another kid by saying, I'm not real sure my brother intended to take that cookie. In fact, he may not have known it was a cookie, or he may have forgotten about the rules. But I felt inclined to let you know that because I love you so much that my brother took a cookie. I can't tell why. I thought you would want to know. Nah, that never happens. This is what happens. Mom, I watched my brother wait until your back was turned. He snuck and took that cookie and he thought he could get away with it. The crime gets reported with the insinuation that there is plenty of motive behind it. And it was an absolute disregard of your authority. That's how the Chaldeans reported the crime. These men pay no attention to you, King. There is probably no truth to that statement. I bet the fact that the king gave his death sentence on this action, I bet that had their full attention. Attention was not the issue. Respect was not the issue. Proper regard was not the issue. The issue was one of worship. They probably wanted to do what the king asked in one way, but they were not allowed to by their God, nor did they want to dishonor their God. And they were not going to do it. Then the Chaldeans get to their point. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the burning furnace. That was the end goal of the Chaldeans' malicious intent. While Daniel would not allow these same people to be put to death when Daniel had the chance, the same would never be true about the Chaldeans. Their envy and hatred had no boundaries. Verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Have you ever made decisions in a furious rage? How'd that go for you? Are you proud of what you said? Are you proud of what you did? Wisdom chooses to delay what one says or does in that state. It's very rare that we do or say wise things in the state of rage, especially when our pride is involved. The Chaldeans pushed the king's button. The Chaldeans hit the king's weakness. It was pride. We'll see this later in the rest of the story. Here we see his pride alive and well. Now we're going to stop here. I don't want to go any further into the story because we're approaching the action parts and I don't want to do an injustice by splitting it up. It's just too good of a story. But we're about to see how costly this uncontrolled rage of the king was to him. We'll see what it looks like when people choose not to compromise. We'll see how to speak of God when we're not sure what he's going to do. And we'll see just how far God will go when he wants to make his name known. And that's just a start. So the application for this week might be to take a good hard look at our lives in social settings. How much are we willing to spend to get those things we most want or to avoid those things we least want, especially in worldly settings? What are we willing to do? What price are we willing to pay? What compromise are we willing to make, if any? And is there any way that we compromise our worship of God when we're serving in our secular world? What would we say if the choice was between our lives or the lives of our loved ones and worship of a foreign god of any kind? How would we respond? How would we react? Well, next week, Lord willing, we'll see what happens when the Jewish team makes the right choice. Let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you so much for your word. We thank you so much for the reality of this picture, for the